It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley Brisbane, your host, and this is episode 56. Welcome back to a discussion of classic film. Today's film is No Man of Her Own, 1950, not to be confused with the 1932 version. Maybe we'll get into that, maybe we won't. But before we can get into any details, let us introduce the lovely people who are here to talk about this movie, starting with Nathan Alderman. Hi.
Hello. I'm just over here with a disturbingly realistic newborn baby.
Randy Dotinga, do you have a disturbingly realistic newborn baby as well?
I do not, but I hear that Barbara Stanwyck is in trouble again, and I'm here for it.
Hardly ever happens that Babs is in trouble.
Never.
I'm telling you.
The poor thing. There's always something going on with her.
It's a day that ends with a Y, so Barbara Stanwyck is in trouble. No Man of Her Own, made in 1950, directed by Mitchell Lyson, does indeed star Barbara Stanwyck as our heroine, as well as John Lund, who is her, they know each other. And then a few other folks, including silent film actress Jane Cowell. This is a film based on a Cornell Wooldridge novel called, and we should talk about this title because it's where I start. The original title of the book was I Married a Dead Man. And they decided to change that to No Man of Her Own because they wanted to appeal to the female viewer. I personally think I Married a Dead Man is a great title.
Oh, man, it's an
awesome.
Amazing title.
Isn't it? I mean, especially for, because this is like a noir that's been melodramed. I mean, there's a ton of melodrama, including from the very beginning when we have Barbara Stanwyck doing voiceover of the beautiful suburban house and what could possibly go wrong. And of course, everything is about to go wrong. But it's a noir wrapped inside melodrama directed by Mitchell Lyson, who is one of the famous directors of women in Hollywood, Claudette Colbert, Paulette Goddard, Stanwyck. He directed her on one previous occasion. So like George Cukor, he sort of specialized in women's films and films where women were actually treated pretty well in terms of their performances and all. So we've turned a noir into a melodrama. But let me back up and ask each of you what your experience was with this film. How about you, Randy? Have you seen this one before?
I have not, and I wanted to talk about the title just for a second.
Sure.
As you mentioned, it was a movie before, but this same story has been a couple other movies in the future, and one of them I think has a great name. The French version of this movie is called I Married a Shadow, which is cool. But a version that came out in the 90s. Has the worst title, I think, of all these selections, which is Mrs. Winterbourne.
What?
That is a terrible title. What the heck? That sounds like a Stephen King book set in rural Maine or something, you know?
Yeah.
Another Downton Abbey spinoff.
Right? Yeah. That could work.
Yeah, and it just, like, it came out in the 90s, and I guess no one noticed it. I think it was more like kind of a comedy drama. I was around in the 90s, and I went. That was back when you would go to the theater to see movies.
I read that title in Wikipedia, and I was like, I think I've heard of that, but I didn't go do any research. So to tell us what we know about Mrs. Winterbourne.
So we know Mrs. Winterbourne is a 1996 American romantic comedy drama, and Ricky Lake apparently is the young woman who ends up in an unfortunate train crash, as you do.
Okay.
and then has a baby. And then the mother with a bad heart, this is all according to Wikipedia, the mother with a bad heart, that's Shirley MacLaine. And the brother is Brendan Fraser. So it just, when I hear about this story, I just think feel good hit of the summer, don't you?
Of course, definitely.
Yeah, the tagline on the poster is the story of a girl who's going from filthy to rich. What is even happening?
I know, it's crazy. It's just insane. So Nathan, this is the first time movie, first time watch for you too as well, right?
Yes. Now, you know me, fondness for Barbara Stanwyck goes way back on this podcast,
yes.
But I'd never seen it before, and you know, it didn't really grab me. it's a lot of great ingredients, and I don't think they add up to a satisfying whole. But there's some interesting stuff, a lot of interesting stuff to dig into in this movie. And I would just like to take a moment to say how great both Jane Cowell is.
Yes.
And in his very first ever movie role, Lyle Betger is amazing.
Ooh, he's a bad one, man. He's really good.
John Lund is also present.
In the movie. He's in the movie. So just quickly, one last thing on the title. The original No Man of Verona, 1932, not the same movie at all, made by Paramount. And, I guess Paramount looked back at its name list and said, we haven't used this in 20 years. Nobody remembers it. So we'll just put a different, it's the same name on a totally different movie. But yeah, I think the performances are, by and large, interesting. Lyle Betteger is pretty terrifying. And I can't imagine, I was watching him and I just can't imagine him playing anything other than a villain. And of course, in the way you do when somebody is a past lover of your lead character, you're like, what did she ever see in him? And what circumstance did they get together? Anyway, So the reason that I like this movie is because the plot is so ridiculous. I embrace the ridiculousness of it. We have Barbara Stanwyck, who is a woman in trouble, and the man who she if she doesn't love him anymore, she at least believes he should meet his obligations as far as his child. He isn't going to do it. He gives her a train ticket. How did he just happen to have a train ticket to San Francisco in his room? That's what I want to know. She goes off and gets on a train and ends up switching identities with somebody who dies in a train wreck. And just as a premise for a movie, as ridiculous as it is, I liked it.
I'm gonna really stand up for this movie. I think it's a real hidden gem. It doesn't seem to have been really seen very much. Just judging from how many votes it has on IMDb, it has like, I think it was maybe 2,500 or 5,000, and like Mildred Pierce has 25,000. So it's. And I saw Double Indemnity has 155,000. I may have gone down a wormhole on this, but anyway. I just thought it was just a great combination of women's picture and film noir, with just a completely insane plot. But I with Barbara Stanwyck, I was going to go on her with this trip to Caulfield. In Illinois.
Oh, we're at Caulfield and already? Oh, my goodness.
Whitesville.
I better get the train. Whitesville, right.
I was willing to go with her, and I think I just like the cinematography and the performances, and I think it really is a really nice and fun to watch movie, because, like you said, the fun is in how the plot is bananas.
Well, especially if you watch it a second or a third time, you know at what point everything is going to break and there's going to be the train wreck and she's interacting with the person whose identity she's about to take over. And you watch the little details, things like, oh, well, keep my ring for safekeeping. In fact, why don't you put it on your finger? it's ridiculous things like that that just makes me love this movie.
Could you put this ring on your finger right before the train crash, please? Thank you. Right. Oh, no.
Well, Nathan, you're more cynical than we are. I guess we're just enjoying the ridiculousness of it.
Hey, there's some great stuff in this movie. The sequence where you are watching from Stanwyck's perspective as she is wheeled through the hospital on a gurney and like just the faces swimming into and out of view. What a brilliant and stylish and really gripping way to do that. And toward the end of the film, there's that when it gets really dark and the streets are full of snow and it's the middle of the night, that has a very haunting quality to it as well. Two things I really like about this film. One, it's written by two women, which is really unusual for film noir. And they emphasize female strength and female friendship throughout the movie in ways that you do not see. There are no femme fatales in this movie. In fact, there's a homme fatale. Lyle Betger is 1,000,000% a homme fatale.
Well, there is one femme fatale.
She's there for like a scene.
Literally.
Yeah.
But she's barely even there.
Yeah.
But she's in there the exact right amount that you need her to be to provide the connective tissue, which is really clever. And in fact, she sets that up at she sets up the fact that she's going to kill Lyle Betger at the end of the movie in her very first scene, where she says, if you ever treat me like that, I'll kill you. And you write it off as just like a throwaway line, but she means it. And that's very clever writing. The other thing I liked about this is that it's a film noir where the protagonist consistently makes moral choices. Like, she is not doing anything weaselly out of selfishness or greed. She is given every chance to work this angle to her advantage. And every time she like struggles against it and tries to do the right thing and gets trapped through circumstances not of her own making. And even when she like allows herself to just go ahead with the lie, she's not saying, yes, that is definitely me. I am that person. She's just thinking, I have a baby. This baby needs food and a life. And if these nice people want to give this baby a home and it'll make them happy, I'm not going to stand in their way. So I really like that. It's not about like one bad decision leading to the snowball of bad decisions. It's just a person with rotten luck who's trying repeatedly to do the right thing. And I really enjoy that take on film noir.
I feel like that owes something to the melodramatic aspects, because I feel like if it were a straight up film noir, they might not have done it quite in the same way. They might have made it more about Stanwyck's moral dilemma, and sometimes she makes the right choice and sometimes she sort of makes a slightly wrong one. But every time she has a decision to make, she either is forced to make a certain decision by circumstances, or she makes an affirmative decision to feed her kid, but it's also the right one in terms of the relationships she's building with the family. And all of those times when like when they make the will in her favor and she's like, please don't. And she anytime she's confronted with being given more than she's willing to take, it freaks her out, which is, again, I just feel like that has more to do with melodrama than what we usually think of as film noir.
But it definitely helps to keep you on her side.
Yeah.
Stanwyck is really interesting in this because on one hand, she looks rough in a lot of this movie. You know,
maybe
I'm just used to seeing, you know, 20-something Barbara Stanwyck and Night Nurse and Babyface, but she looks rough in a lot of this movie. And yet, consistent with other Barbara Stanwyck performances, she is out-acting every single other person on the screen. And she is doing incredibly subtle things with the changes of her facial expression that just tell you volumes.
And they give her so many close-ups because they could, given that part of it for her character should look rough, especially in the beginning. But they could make choices. They could soft focus her. They could not quite do so much with close-ups. But given that she's Stanwyck and given that they have her face as that tool, it absolutely makes sense that they would zoom in. And clearly she cooperated with that.
There is a certain degree of Vaseline on the lens, but yes. I do. One of the things I like best about Stanwyck is her absolute willingness to be a rotten person on screen. I first saw her in the movie adaptation of Sorry, Wrong Number. And I was bowled over by the fact that here is this person who produced this movie, is a big movie star, and insisted on playing a deeply unlikable character.
Well, we should watch Strange Love of Martha Ivers sometimes if you want to see her as a deeply unlikable character. Randy, what were you going to say?
Just that she has a lot of key light on her face. Her face is always lit up, and she doesn't look fantastic. I wonder if she went light on the makeup or what she did to. But I think it's always got to be a difficult choice for an actress.
She's in her early 40s by this point, and she acted for a really long time. I mean, she had a TV series in the 60s. She died in like 83 and was acting right up until the time she died. She was not afraid of being in her 40s, 50s, 60s and saying, look, I'm an older woman and I'm going to still be Barbara Stanwyck. But I think it's not that she in real life looks this rough and will never look better. I feel like it is a choice that they made because there are movies in this era where she's a little more glammed up than she is in this picture.
Also, I wanted to say, was Barbara Stanwyck just unusually tiny? Because in that opening scene when she's holding what has to be like a 2-year-old child, that child is a good 80% her size.
I know.
I have large
too.
Children. I know from large children. My 6-year-old comes up to like my upper rib cage on me. But that was either a large child or that is a tiny Barbara Stanwyck.
Well, I did my usual thing whenever I watch an old movie. I go on IMDb and see who's still alive, if anybody. And the babies were not credited, even in the, you know, down in the part where they have the people who are uncredited but end up on the, you know, the full cast list. So I'm very curious. Baby, if you are out there, or babies, I think there are multiple babies, please get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you.
That is a real newborn baby. Like, you look at that child and the stiff kind of jerky way it's moving, that is a, you never see a baby that young in anything today. I guess Hollywood was like, child labor laws, what are those?
It made hardly any sound either. I mean, I think it might have cooed once or twice, but, and IMDb says she's 5'5", and my recollection is that when you see, and I know they put people on boxes and stuff, but my recollection is when you see her with sort of average height actors, she doesn't seem particularly tiny, and 5'5 is sort of, you know, middle height for a woman. Well,
dang, then she must have been jacked, because that was a very large child.
Barbara Stanwyck is jacked.
She must have been lifting weights off between takes. But yeah, I was just astonished. Like, there is one thing, my wife does not in any way, shape, or form have any interest in old movies, but you tell her there's a cute baby in it, and she will come watch. So she very much enjoyed the panoply of adorable baby/infant content in this movie. And there is a lot, and those kids are very cute.
I was going to mention, I don't know if we're going to get to it, but Phyllis Thaxter, is that? I looked into her history, and she actually played the mother who adopted Superman in the original Superman movie.
Oh, in the 70s Superman movie?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because she had a career as sort of a second lead in the 40s, I think, at MGM. So there are a lot of movies where, she might have had a couple of actual leads, but she was like the second lead's girlfriend or the secretary or something like that. So, and she, I'd have to look at her IMDb, but she's well known enough in that period where people would have gone, oh yeah, Phyllis Thaxter, I know her. And she's a very small part.
I like Hugh and Patrice. We don't get to see them very long, and they are, you know, it's 1950, so they are mayonnaise on white bread, but they're just genuinely kind. And I like that they are shown like seeing, oh, this is a person in trouble. We're not going to like embarrass her, humiliate her, but we are going to reach out. We are going to make sure this person is okay. I really like that about them. And it helps you to like kind of root for their family later, because you know that the family that produced these folks were good people.
I like the way they're written, especially Phyllis Thaxter's character, too, because there's sort of a banter between them. They're a newly married couple. And the banter actually sounds a little bit more like older married, but she's basically saying, you know, get out of here. I'm going to talk to this woman. And you know, both of them seem kind. They seem good together. But I sort of like that there's a little bit of a playful spirit to them.
And there's a tension about Helen Ferguson. I'm worried about her in her scenes. Is she going to lighten up a little bit? Is she going to warm up to them? I'm just concerned. They seem so nice, and she does kind of warm up, and then that's a very harrowing, like just a few seconds of the train crash, which I thought was notable.
Well, and again, that because I've seen this multiple times, I don't remember exactly at what moment in the scene the crash happens, so I know it's coming, and I know that it has to be after she's taken the ring, but it surprised me because it happens when she goes to look out the window, and then the window shatters, and then there's this, you know, noise and terrible. It's interesting both to know and to not know, because if you don't know, you absolutely do not expect it, because it's this scene where the women are in the bathroom getting ready for bed and they're bonding. And by the way, we last talked about train restroom facilities when we talked about the narrow margin and the giant bathrooms on trains. This one particularly large, I guess, for the women's room is, I don't know. Anyway, but so the crash is, it is pretty harrowing. And obviously you don't know who's made it out for a while, and there's a lot of sort of fuzzy in and out. Then we go to the hospital, and it's just, yeah, I think it creates sort of a discombobulated few moments for the audience because they really don't know quite what has happened. And I like the way that was staged.
Does she look 8 months or whatever it is, 8 months pregnant?
No, no,
oh, no,
no,
no.
She does look, both of them look moderately pregnant, like just the tiniest smidge pregnant, which is more than like, that movie we just saw?
Gene Tierney and Leave Her to Heaven.
Leave Her to Heaven, yeah, where she's just like wearing a beautiful woman wearing a very large coat. So they do look sort of a little bit like maybe 4 or 5 months pregnant tops. But no, having been married to a woman who was twice 8 months pregnant, not even close. And I do not understand Hollywood's terror at this time of just depicting women at, you know, in a state of gravidity, let's say.
They went as far as to make her pregnant, but we can't see visible evidence of it, I guess.
Exactly. And this is at a time when America's like, women make babies, so many babies, babies everywhere. And yet you can't show a pregnant lady on screen. What the heck?
I noticed that they mentioned that the baby was put in an incubator, and that made an impression on me because my mom was born in 1941 and she weighed 3 pounds and 9 ounces. She was premature. And she ended up spending 2 months in an incubator. And at that time, incubators were fairly new. And I know in the 20s and 30s, you could actually go someplace like Coney Island or Atlantic City, and you would see incubators on the boardwalk. You would pay 25 cents to get to go in and see the babies in the incubators. You can also see that in the Boardwalk Empire on HBO.
That doesn't surprise me. The 20s and 30s were a weird time. Of course, that's the mid-30s, you had the Dion quintuplets, and the world just freaked the heck out for, you know, because there were quintuplets. Anyways, so. Yeah, but incubators, I think, by the 50s were pretty common. And I know, like, I have a friend who was in an incubator in the early 60s and ended up being blind because of it, and which happened relatively often if it was done improperly. Well, the other thing about that whole hospital sequence there is that I like the doctor's line. Well, here, have some coddled eggs, and if you're feeling better, in a week you get to see your baby. Like, oh my God.
Yeah, that's horrifying because, yes. I mean, in the hospital where my wife gave birth, they make sure that baby is almost never away from its mom. Like, they want that baby bonding with its mom, you know, snuggled up to its mom, nursing from its mom as much as possible. And to be like, yeah, your babies, I hope there are some nurses cuddling that baby, because for the first week of life, if no one is picking up that baby, oh God, he's going to grow up to be a serial killer.
It's pretty standard to be at that time to maybe have been in a hospital for 5 days or so. And she might've had other injuries related to the accident, but the idea that you wouldn't see your baby for all that time, that's just, I just can't imagine any medical rationale for that at all. It's probably something like, well, it'll upset the woman.
Somehow. Yes, what if she gets too excited and her uterus clambers out of her?
Well, I'm worried about those coddled eggs. You know, if you coddle an egg, they grow up spoiled. It's just awful.
I hate when that happens. So now she wakes up and she has the identity of Patrice, the person who was killed in the train, because she's wearing the ring. And conveniently, the family had never seen Patrice. There's no photos he got married, but he didn't send the family a photo or anything. So, well, good for Barbara. She's adopted into this family that includes Bill, the brother, and the mother, played by Jane Cowell, the father, played by Henry O'Neill, who played many fathers in many movies that I've seen. He's one of those guys that he's either always a father or he's like a ruthless businessman kind of guy. But it's just this sort of benevolent, sweet. Oh, and they have their housekeeper, Josie, is there. So it's like this whole just family of people waiting to. And I don't know how much time has passed other than it's been a week before she gets to see the baby. But they don't seem to be grieving particularly by the time she gets to their house.
Well, I think that, like, the fact that Patrice survived and there's a baby, that's like they are in mourning when they show up, and they mention that, like, the baby was the only thing that kept Mrs. Harkness and her vague convenient heart ailment from you know, taking to her bed. But I think it's just they're so excited they have a baby. Oh my gosh, there was this train crash, but this miracle child emerged from it. So, of course, they're going to be excited. And then John Lund is also present. I guess we'll have to talk about him at some point. He gives off big, big Jesse Plemons with a head injury energy. Nothing he ever says or does is interesting or convincing in the slightest. He claims that he's in love with Barbara Stanwyck, and you're like, when? How?
Right. He also has a really big head.
Yeah, but he is a large square.
Exactly.
In every sense of the word. But it turns out that it's good to have a giant slab of beef around when you need to move a body.
Yeah, that comes in handy later on. Thanks, John Lund.
Basically, yeah, they just dressed up a side of beef, stuck an unconvincing mustache on it, and then, like, rolled it around on wheels and had someone dub in the dialogue.
Harsh. There's some quotes from John Lund that he actually didn't think all that much of his own appearance or his, I don't know that he criticized his own acting so much, but his appearance, he made comments like, I'm better viewed from far away or something like that, which I guess if you kind of are self-aware enough to say a thing like that, that's good. Good for you, John Lund.
Nice to know John Lund and I have that in common. Better viewed from a distance in the dark with poor eyesight.
Here you go.
I think he really came alive when they're trying to get rid of the body. He really kind of shows off kind of a sinister side.
He becomes a noir guy at that point. And I do.
Yeah.
I think that's true. I think he's doing his best. He's not as good as anybody else in the movie. But I do feel like that's the point at which, yeah, he does come to life.
Yeah, the movie's chugging along nicely down melodrama lane, and then it takes a hard right down noir alley. Ooh. And I am here for it.
Yes.
It is gorgeous, bleak. There is nothing bleaker than like wintertime in the Midwest when the snow has fallen and then had a chance to melt and turn to slush in the gutters, but it's still freezing cold outside. I have lived that. There is nothing bleaker than that, and it is a great setting for, you know, dumping a body on a moving train.
As Barbara Stanwyck gets more comfortable with the family, and the family bonds with her and with the baby, and they're just nothing but nice to her. And there are these little bits in which she sort of slips about not knowing things that Patrice should know, or, you know, not knowing her husband's favorite song, which, come on, under what circumstances, how long have they been married? I don't know. Why would she know his favorite song? Whatever. But then gradually we see the girlfriend of the new girlfriend who's going to be our femme fatale in the store. Then Barbara Stanwyck makes a mistake that John Lund sees. So that's the point at which he kind of starts to know that something's up. And then a little later on, then we meet our villain, Lyle Bettinger. Oh, God, terrifying, terrifying.
He's so good because he's so still. You mm-hmm. don't know anything about him and you don't need to. You get the barest minimum of information about who this guy is. He does not talk a lot. He just is incredibly still, like he's barely even human. And it is amazing. What a performance.
Right. And the way he speaks sort of confirms that, because he doesn't really open his mouth. He doesn't move his head. He just give me the money. And that's a terrible Lyle Bettinger impression, and I apologize. But I didn't really think of it quite that way until you said that, Nathan, but I think you're right. I think it's because there's so little movement, there's so little give. Like, he's a brick wall, basically, but yep. A terrifying one.
He is just an implacable force.
And John Lund is totally okay with this creepy guy taking away Helen or Patrice off to the outside the where they're dancing and standing out there for a while. He just doesn't think anything of it.
Right. It's one thing to cut in, which I don't know. I always find the sort of rules behind you can cut in on somebody's dance kind of weird and inexplicable. And that's the way a lot of bad guys get together with women in movies. But then he takes her outside for a long conversation. And yeah, you would think John Lund would be like, I've never met this man. I know everybody else in this country club right now, but this strange man has taken her outside. At the very least, he would kind of stand by the door and watch, and you can tell by their body language that something is not right. Yeah, John Lund should have gone out there.
Now, do we think that John Lund fell in love with Barbara Stanwyck knowing that she was not his dead brother's wife? Because if, you know, he does say that he twigs to it pretty early on, and so that's fair. But if you assume that he goes into this thinking that she is his dead brother's wife, and he's like, ooh, what a catch. I'm going to scoop me up some of that. That's
messed up.
Disturbing on a lot of levels, including John Lund being like, well, the only woman good enough for me is my dead brother's wife.
My half-baked theory is that as he is suspecting her, he's watching her more closely, and that causes him to be aware of his attraction for her. And so before he's even sure... Because I think it's entirely just as if you say to somebody, well, when did you fall in love, or when did you fall in love at first sight? You only know that in retrospect. You probably didn't say, on this date at this time, I fell in love with you. But if you look back, you can kind of, and I think it's probably the same way here, because he's like, there's something not quite right. And then when he puts it all together, by which point he's fallen in love with her, he's like, yeah, I kind of knew you weren't who you said you were, but I also was falling in love with you right at that moment.
It's also weird to be like, this person is lying about being my dead brother's wife and, you know, carrying his child. Wow, she's so hot.
What is it?
They say he didn't date much, and, you know, I'm kind of seeing that.
He's never seen a woman before.
Doesn't he say something like, I don't care? He says, like, I know, because she sort of confesses, and he says, yeah, I know, and I don't care, and which that comes off like, what? Huh?
I can buy that because he has seen how relentlessly kind she is to his parents, how, you know, what a good mom she is, how she strives to make them happy, how she's never, you know, asked for things for herself. She's not trying to rip them off. She's in fact saying, no, don't give me all the money. That, I think, you know, helps him say, I don't care, because he can tell that she is a decent person.
I agree with that, but I think his acting is limited enough that it sounds like he never cared, that it never mattered to him. But what he's actually saying is, look, I know the truth, and I don't care because you're a good person, and I love you, and or I'm hot for you, or whatever it is.
Yes, he does not convey any. He does not. I don't know if he conveys a single emotion in this entire film. He says words and he does things, and I think that's about it.
Well, there's an old line about, I think it's about Katharine Hepburn, that her acting runs the gamut from A to B.
Yeah, that was a Dorothy Parker quote from a play in the 1930s, which apparently wasn't very good.
I think John Lund is lucky to get to A.
But John Lund.
Instead of further bagging on poor John Lund, can we talk about how thunderously awesome Jane Cowell is?
Yes, please.
And how awesome Mrs. Harkness is? She's terrific. She's just so vibrant and real, and she plays every scene with this top coat of love and this undercurrent of deep sadness and wistfulness that just works. And she's the only actor in this entire film. I mean, even Bettger, he's great, but Stanwyck can act him off the screen. Cowell is the only one who can really hold her own with Stanwyck.
And they have a good chemistry together. They really do.
Yeah. And Mrs. Harkness is a stone badass. Oh, I'm dying of a heart attack, but I think my beloved daughter might be off to murder a guy. Let me write her an alibi before I die.
And put on a hat and coat.
Holy crud, that lady is just solid steel.
You go, Jane Cowell.
Her heart couldn't keep up with the rest of her.
She's got an Ethel Barrymore vibe, and Ethel Barrymore would have played a part like that, except that Jane Cowell has more heart than Barrymore did. I don't want to disparage Ethel Barrymore completely, but I remember seeing this time when I watched it, and I was thinking, that's a part Ethel Barrymore would have played right about that time, and I think she could have. But I think Cowell gives it sort of an emotional, and she's the one that is. I mean, all of them are really welcoming to Patrice Helen when she comes, but Jane Cowell's character is really the one who makes space for her and says, and she's obviously a mother as well, so she has some of that sort of natural bonding connection, but she also is just like, I get what you're going through, because I'm probably the one that's the most sad that your husband is dead.
Unfortunately, Jane Cowell actually passed away the year the movie came out. She was 66.
Whoa, that is way too young, but it's incredible. If this was her final performance, it is astonishing. She was great.
It looks like she was in a couple other movies. I'm looking here. Something called The Secret Fury, which looks like a film noir. And something
Please
called
tell me
Payment.
She was The Secret Fury.
I don't think she'd be very secret.
No, but Barbara Stanwyck made a movie right about this time called The Furies, not the same one at all, but anyway, sorry.
And it says it was also one starring Betty Davis called Payment on Demand.
Probably seen it, but I don't remember it.
And she was an actress in the silent era, and she was known as Crying Jane because I guess she just liked to weep on screen.
She actually doesn't have that many credits. It looks like she lived at least until 1953.
This is her second to last credit for Payment on Demand is the last one. Well, there's
Passed away in 1950.
Wow, interesting, because she's in, she was a writer.
She was a writer, yeah.
Wow.
Her last
she was
acting
a writer
credit
and
is
an actress.
Oh.
She doesn't have tons of writing. That's cool, though. Smiling
that's
through,
astonishing.
She wrote. Wow. We're and just going to stop and read IMDb, everybody.
Yeah, not that many acting credits either. That's
bizarre.
I think
she had a stage career. I'd have to look it up, but I believe that in addition she was did some Broadway stuff, but I'm not certain of it. But no, she's great.
Yeah, I see at Broadway that she was actually in a play with Katharine Hepburn, of all people, of A to B.
Which, what was the play?
No wonder she died at 67 of cancer. That explains it.
It says the play was called Art and Mrs. Bottle.
That's a very early one. I am
1930.
Something of a Hepburnologist. So, well, let's see. So we are at the point now where our villain is in the piece. And of course, as good blackmailers do, he gets more on Patrice by getting her to sign over this check. You know, first she's going to give him a blank check, not putting her name on it, and then he says, "No, put your name on it, otherwise I won't leave." And then he immediately says, "Ha ha, I'm not leaving because your name's on it, and now there's evidence." And so we know that this is not going to go well. And pretty early on, I guess there is a little time that passes, but I am a little surprised at the point when she's basically like, "I am totally going to kill him." She doesn't end up killing him, but she would have. I mean, she absolutely would've.
And he would have had it coming.
Yes. Yeah. I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying that as moral as Barbara Stanwyck is through this whole movie, when her life and her new family, because you can tell that she's protecting the family that she's now a part of. She's absolutely protecting Jane Cowell, who has this, you know, random and convenient heart ailment. She's protecting the father, who's also a benevolent character, and she probably has feelings for Bill at this point. But she's protect, and yes, you can say she's protecting the family that whatever happens will be the family of her child. That's absolutely true. But I think she genuinely cares for these people who have cared for her.
Yeah, and that's why she does it. That's what makes this so compelling. If it were just her, she would let this guy drag her through the mud. Her character very clearly does not think very much of herself throughout this entire film, which is an interesting angle for any character to play. But when he threatens the family and these nice people who've been nothing but kind to her, she's going to go all Stan Wick on him.
And I do like the bit where he's on the phone with her and the mother, Jane Cowell's character, overhears. So she actually, that's sort of the plausibility of why is she aware of this? Because the only person that really has significant evidence that Patrice is not Patrice is Bill. But the mother then gets this confirmation. She's on the phone with this guy who sounds like he's being kind of mean to her. Maybe we should find out. And they go through all these weird machinations of, you know, call the operator and trace the call, which I think go on a little bit too long. But, you know, it's all in service of suspense, I suppose.
And it's neat that Jane Cowell's character has that agency and that, you know, that drive, that capability. She's not just, "Oh, I'm passive and fragile and old and I may die at any moment." She's like, "No, trace the call. We're going to save this woman." I love that. It's so cool.
So basically the blackmailer's ultimate plan is I'm going to make Barbara Stanwyck marry me because that way when she comes into this inheritance, and he doesn't even know how much she's going to inherit because she's basically going to get 3/4 of the dad's money. The son will get the business, but she's been given this incredible amount of dough. And all that Steve knows is that when the mother dies, when Jane Cowell dies, she's in line for something. And obviously, you know, it doesn't matter that he doesn't know that. It's just interesting because he's just like, she starts out wanting, you know, a little bit of money, which he will continue to ask for, obviously. But then he's like, "Here's my grand plan. I'm going to make you marry me. So that way when they kick it and you inherit this money, it'll all come to me. Although, what are the legalities of, wait, if we find out who she really was?" And I don't know. It could be a mess at probate. I'm just saying.
I don't think he's planning to stick around for probate. I think he's planning to clean out the bank accounts and Vemoose.
Yeah, I thought it was poignant that how he says, "Well, she's going to die and then he'll die right after."
Right.
Which apparently is completely correct.
Apparently. He has a really good read on Jane Cowell and Henry O'Neill's health, apparently.
I can diagnose people just by looking at him. It's one of my talents, along with being a sociopath. Yeah, I like how this movie doubles down a lot. Like, he's not just despicable enough to, like, get a check from her and then get on a train. He's despicable enough to be like, okay, now that I know you're weak enough that you'll write me a check, I'm going to kidnap you and force you to marry me. That, it's like he's despicable on top of despicable. And then even at the end, you know, when they get the out of Jane Cowell being like, hey, guys, I wrote you an alibi from beyond the grave because I love you so much, they don't use it. This movie, like, knows...
Bill wants her to use it, and Barbara Stanwyck's ultimate moral choice is, no, we're not doing that, because I don't want your mother's memory sullied by this thing.
Yeah, they really know how, at the right moments, to raise the stakes here. It's dramatically inert for a lot of the running time, but it does get better toward the end, and they know when to raise the stakes at the right moment to make you care about what's going on screen.
So our blackmailer gets killed, and did Barbara Stanwyck do it? Did Bill do it? Did Jane Cowell do it? Who did it? It turns out it was the girlfriend who threatened him initially that if you treat me like you treated Barbara Stanwyck, gonna kill you. And so she does, and the police at the end, the plainclothes detective, played by Milburn Stone, well known as Doc on Gunsmoke for a long time, comes in and he says, hey, we found a body, and there's a check with your name on it, and she says, I think I'll confess. It's like, that's really interesting, because he wasn't killed with the same kind of gun you've got, and we found the check on somebody else's person who has the gun, but you know, tomorrow you can come down to the police station and clear it up. He's not. They feel like they've got their killer and they don't really want to pursue the case. And these are, you know, pretty important citizens of the town. I do feel like there's a lot of that. I feel like when the police get involved, they basically make an appointment to show up and they show up. And even when Barbara Stanwyck pretty much confesses, he's like, you know what? Why don't you just come down tomorrow? We'll sort it out.
You belong to the country club. Just turn in your get out of crime free card and you'll be fine.
Now, did you guys pick up on when Barbara Stanwyck is trying to shoot the bad guy? I feel like her gun goes off, but there's no all the bullets are still in the gun.
Well, they say that there's a bullet in the mattress. So he's dead by this point. And I guess she misses.
But that shot of him lying on the bed, staring at her lifelessly, is so eerie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's also the whole scene where they go out and dump the body, and they have to carry him up and throw him off that platform. That was just so well lit and so creepy. It was very atmospheric.
You can tell it's a good film noir if there is an implied train. We talked about that in The Phantom Lady, and here they don't show a train. They just show a puff of smoke behind a brick wall, but it's really cleverly done. I also love the shot where John Lund is carrying the body down the staircase, and the only light is coming from the street outside. That is a heck of
it's
a shot.
Cool. They make that whole sequence go on for a pretty good long time, and I don't think it's too long. I think they don't really, because when they have a body to deal with, they don't really have a complete plan. They don't know who's going to go where. They don't know how they're going to deal with it. And so there is, I like the amount of sort of, holy crap, now we have to deal with a body. They interact with the cops who then get a call and leave. And
at the exact moment that the cop is about to look in the car and see Barbara Stanwyck hiding inside, at which point she will have a lot of awkward explaining to do, they're like, hey, somebody across town is shooting. It's America, so this happens a lot.
And the poor bad guy, now, did he hit the catwalk and his head came off? I didn't quite understand. I thought the idea was to throw him on the track, but apparently there was a mishap along the way.
I can't tell whether that his hat came off was like a euphemism for he was decapitated.
I thought it was his hat or head.
They said his hat.
Oh, his hat. Okay, I was thinking he was decapitated. I was like, this guy's collated quickly.
Yes, the value of the hat would be, I guess you could identify him if he had like his initials in it, because sometimes that happens in movies.
But I thought it was just a nicely quotidian detail. Like John Lund's character is so in shock that, you know, he just dumped a dead body on a moving train and he's like, his hat came off. Just like, that doesn't matter.
No good.
But it's
comes
the kind
of
thing a shocked person would notice.
Yeah, true. Well, what else do we want to say about this? We've kind of run through the ending, which is basically they get off. You know, at the beginning of the movie, the whole thing is a flashback. So at the beginning of the movie, John Lund and Barbara Stanwyck are sort of looking at each other going, oh, we're going to be in trouble and where things are weird. And then at the end, it all turns out right, because it turns out that that Steve's girlfriend was in fact the killer. And I guess Stanwyck and Lund can go back to their life, and maybe there won't even be anything in the newspapers. I don't know.
You win again, white privilege.
Exactly. Well, thanks, gentlemen, for taking this ride with me on the Barbara Stanwyck train. I'm always all about Barbara Stanwyck trains. And it was really fun to watch No Man of Her Own with you. If you want to keep up with what's going on with Lions, Towers, and Shields, please go to theincomparable.com/LTS. You can follow us on Twitter at Lion Tower Shield, because S's cost extra. We also have a brand new email address, lts@theincomparable.com. Keep in touch. Subscribe. Don't forget to write. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with another film, this time 1957's Sweet Smell of Success. Bye now.